by low-income housing. But that in the life of that church, not one of the stained glass windows has ever been broken in that church. Every window around the church has probably been broken at some time. But there's been a kind of respect even for the church building, that young people would not throw bricks and not cause damage to that church building because of the respect. Even though the building has been broken into by some persons, they still didn't break the windows and that kind of thing. And he felt, and I would agree with him, that that was not by accident. That was just not a fluke. That there was a kind of reverence for that place. I suggest, though, that that's not going to continue to be the case, that that's beginning to change and will affect the way the church ministers to children and to its community. Lincoln and Mamelia say in their book that they believe that there are two major challenges that confront black churches as it relates to children. First of all, the problem of identity among black children. Who are they? A tremendous challenge when the church had that relationship with the entire family. They mentored the whole family. Part of one's identity was related to one's identification with a particular church. A sense of self-worth that was developed because you had persons who were literally in the local church, who were part of the extended family that I'll talk about, that helped form values, that helped establish traditions, that helped to give people a sense of self-worth, a sense of belonging beyond their own existence. That's one of the challenges now when we are not relating as well to the community. The second challenge they see is the issue of the growing sector of unchurched black teenagers and young adults. That those are the two major challenges. Black families and black churches have constituted the enduring institutions in black communities. I'm often asked why the black church continues to survive in the midst of all that has gone in our existence as people who are oppressed. And one of the reasons I think we continue to survive and will continue to thrive, but in a different way, is that the church is still an institution. And for some, other than the family, the black church is the last institution in the black community. So the importance of that as an institution in the survival and the well-being of all of its people, young and old, is such a critical factor that we're going to continue to see. I'm asked at the seminary, I may have said it this way, I'm asked at the seminary often, why do we still have a black church and a white church? Which I think is a very good question. Those of us who are Christians would generally support the fact that we believe that there's one church, the Church of Jesus Christ, and that at the basic level, it's not a black church. There's not a black church and there's not a white church at the very basic level. But the need for people who are oppressed to have a voice, to have a place of freedom, almost requires that the black church continue to exist. It's still the voice for the community, still the advocate for the community. It was no accident at all, surely, that the civil rights movement had its impetus in the black church. When you think of the pivotal role the church played in the lives of all people, and part of the struggle was for the young people. Many of the older people felt that we want a better day for the children. And so the effort, the commitment was through the church because, first of all, the church provided a place for assembly. It provided a group of people who had already some kind of connection. It also provided a minister who had a sense of freedom that no one else in the African-American community had. It was a person that was, to a great degree, allowed to freely speak without the kind of reprisals on Monday morning from that person that they may have to face and work for, who might say, we're not happy with what you're doing on the weekends, and we may need to reduce our workforce. And so you had that minister who at least had his salary, or her salary, I guess, supported by black people directly, without without having to answer directly to someone else. And so that's one of the kind of reasons, other than the kind of expectation for leadership for the black pastor, that we had black ministers in such visible roles in the civil rights movement. And I see that as a movement of liberation, but a real movement of liberation of children, a real hope for a better day that kind of paralleled the theology of the church. Now, the church didn't always preach this otherworldly gospel. It will always be better by and by when we get to heaven. The church didn't really always preach that. It really preached that we want our pie now. And, you know, and so there was a need for the church to do that. But in reality, in their hearts, many hoped, if not for me, surely for my children, I want a better day. And so the church took on a relationship of really caring and nurturing children because it saw the hope for the community in the children. And so there's always been a strong commitment and relationship of the church with children. The family, the extended family that I'll talk about, and the church, which I consider part of the extended family, was very pro-children, very much so. And I believe that that grew, and Lincoln and Mamaria, Kwanzaa Kanjufu supports the same position in some of his works, that I believe that this desire, this commitment to children grew out of the slavery experience in America. I'm not going to say it began there, but that strong commitment to children grew out of the slavery experience. And why so? Well, when you think about what happened in slavery, often parents were separated from their children, children separated from their parents. There was a need for caregiving of children. So the community saw a need to reach out to children who may, in many instances, have had their parents sold, moved to other plantations. There was a need then for the big community to absorb these kids into their families. There was a sense of we need to just think of the family as a whole, not think of those individual nuclear families. There's often the terrible model that I think does not really reflect the strength of the African-American family. And so I think out of this slavery, caring for children, caring for each other, the church, from its inception as sort of an independent black church, during the Civil War, I think the Southern Baptist Convention about 1845, about that time we found that there existed several kinds of congregations in the African-American community. You had the African-Americans who attended literally all white churches. They were allowed to have some kind of involvement, usually not full voting rights, but they were part of the church. They were allowed to come and hear the sermon. They often sat in the balcony or in the back, but at least they had some exposure. Sometimes a very selected gospel was preached to them, the kind of gospel that many say, you know, proposed slaves obey your masters, that kind of gospel. But they began to, again, hear the word of God. You also had existing in that period and before and a little bit after that, you had the black church that had white leadership. You had a white pastor who served the black congregation. Often the congregation was supported by the white congregation of the community. And so there, when we talk about today churches coming together, churches, they were together. We're the ones who broke them apart. You know, society broke them apart. And then eventually you had the black church with black leadership that began to emerge. And by 1880, you had, I'm a Baptist, so by 1880, we had the National Baptist Conventions forming, sort of out of a need to carry the word of God back to Africa, a need to minister the word to the broader community, also an educational need. Right from the beginning, the relationship between education, upward mobility, and the church, they were always connected right from the beginning. They saw the church as an avenue for advancing people. It was not just personal salvation, but it was also the salvation of a people. And this need for people to have a greater power, higher power, to help them overcome the obstacles and problems that existed in their day. And so by 1880s, the Methodist Church had some earlier beginnings. We had strong black congregations and even denominations organizing. And these early churches had a lot of emphasis and have continued to have emphasis on children. Right from its inception, the black church had children's days and youth Sundays. And the church has continued to support things like junior ushers and junior deacons, sort of training people. Well, in that training, they were teaching values. They were teaching responsibility. They were even teaching some work ethics. Baby consecrations and dedications, even with those denominational groups that did not believe in infant baptism, there was a commitment to the dedication of children unto the Lord and a sense of the family needing to present their children back to God so that God would bless them and that they would be guided by God in the raising of their children. Seeing this strong commitment of church to children. Births were often publicly announced. It was a big deal to have a baby. It was not shameful to have a baby. People were proud to have children. People were honored to have children. And that became a major part. And through this day, premarital counseling for prospective couples to set a tone about how you raise children and take care of children as part of that training that the church saw as an important relationship of the church to the family. And many family activities that often involve children. Some of us remember, I grew up in the rural in Virginia. Some of us remember all-day church. Even as a pastor, I don't like all-day church. But some of us remember going to church, being there all day, literally all day. You didn't leave the grounds from Sunday school until dark. But with that, there were many social events, dinners at the church, church picnics, and that's not only germane to the African-American community, but it was so important because that was one of the major outlets, not only for the religious training, but for the social orientation that was so much important, so critically important to the growth and the development of the children. And so you had what developed, I think we don't have a parallel in the predominantly white church to bus tours to visit other churches almost every Sunday. Okay, vacation trips where church members with their children get on a bus and go on a vacation for 2 weeks together. Athletic events, recreational events. Churches were concert halls and art galleries and public forums. I would contend that the first public performance seen or given by many black children occurred in the church. They met and were mentored by older people who served as role models for them. And so we see that black children had a lot of support with that local church. They learned public speaking at church. They memorized that poem and stood there for the Christmas program and had to quote that, could not read it, had to quote it, had to memorize it. Some of us as adults can still remember some of those, okay? Well, what did that do, though? It gave them a sense of being connected. It provided some of the things that now I think we don't see as readily in the church. And I think one of the things that led to such a strong, I'm all hooked up here, okay? One of the things that led to this strength and survival for the African-American community, I'm trying to see if I can move to a side where you can see me here. They had me wired up so I can only go so far. All right. Martin and Martin, who are social workers, several of you are social workers here, I'm sure, have written a book called The Black Extended Family. They're social workers in the Maryland area. And they have contended in their book that when we look at the black family, one of the things we have to look at is how strong is this extended family? And that may be an indicator if there are crisis issues, crisis situations developing in the family fiber of the black family. And their contention, and I buy it wholeheartedly, is that the nuclear family, if one examines only the nuclear family, one has not adequately studied and examined whether a family, a black family, is healthy or not. That a better reflection of whether the black family is a healthy family is this extended family, this sense of connection. And what they say in their books, that there is a extended family base. There's a home base for the family. Now, this is not only black families, but they say it, for people who are an oppressed community, that this structure is more critical, much more critical for their survival. And so there's this extended home base. And at that home base, that's generally the residence of this dominant family figure or personality. Okay? That it is a home. But they don't say this in the book, but this is my addition to them, that also there was that home church that was part of that base for that family. This extended family with this dominant family figure. I, if you may allow me to be personal here, I'll use, and as I've said this before, as a preacher, black preachers, we have what is called a sanctified imagination. Okay, we don't lie, we are very creative with our imaginations under the Holy Spirit, you know. And so if you will allow me to dress up my family story a little bit, I'll add some things that are not exactly true, but I believe God will forgive me, all right? I have a good purpose in what I'm doing. I want to use my family as sort of as an illustration, my father's side of the family, and this glue in the Walker family, Virginia, Heatsville, Virginia, was Ella Walker, my father's mother. She was literally the glue that kept our family together. And part of what she was able to do in keeping the family together, she was a very committed, religious, Christian person. And so her values could be evident in all of the generations that she had some opportunity to influence, okay? Her commitment to the church, in fact, she and her first husband, before he died, were the founders of the local church there. And so she was respected first lady of that church. And after he died, she married my grandfather, and it was his first cousin. That part is still true. And so my family, the Walker family, had its base in a home place, but also in a church that was home. And so the values for that family were pretty consistent because the home and the church kind of proposed and purported the same values. Well, what happened? Literally, there are not enough circles here. There were 12 children in a family with two different husbands. There were 12 children. There were vast differences also in the age of the children. In fact, some of the older children had children as old as some of her younger children. And so what happened, this rural community, fishing and farming town, literally there were no jobs. And so many of the family, the siblings, had to move to various places of the country. Some went to Detroit and Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Baltimore. They went to the major urban centers north of Virginia. And as they went to those areas and they started their little families in those areas, some of them began to lose contact with each other. For some very obvious reasons, the age differences were so different. And so they had very little in common other than the blood ancestry. But they all maintained contact with this dominant family figure at the home base. And she always knew what was going on with every little subgroup. And so if there was a crisis, let's say, involving children, she knew about that and had the ability to communicate that to all of the sub-extended family units. Martin and Martin's position is that as long as this system is somehow together, it helped provide a mutual aid system for the community, for the family. It provided emotional support. I know some of you are here and involved in adoption. We literally now are beginning to have, I think it's one of the best examples, we're having a much greater need for adoption in the black community. We didn't have the level of need previously, primarily because of what Martin and Martin considered absorption and informal adoption. And I'll create a story now, okay? Let's say this sub-extended unit, Detroit, I'll be sexist too, so you can really get me. The wife dies, and the husband comes home for the funeral with five children, and is literally pulling his hair out saying, I don't know how I'm going to take care of these five children. Okay? At the funeral, without making any requests, family members are already aware of what the situation is. And they are at the funeral deciding who will take which child. The mentality is that if we have five children, we can feed six. Okay? Now, what Martin and Martin are saying is that as we move to more materialistic, individualistic society, when that family comes together, today, they're not doing that. Because each of my children has to have their own bedroom. Okay? They don't want to share space with a cousin who has to move in with them. And for Martin and Martin, they're saying, and I agree with them, that for an oppressed community, especially that becomes a crisis for an oppressed community. Okay? I'll give you another example. I'll kind of make this one up. This one's half true. The family in Detroit, you remember, remember in Detroit when they had the mass layoffs of people who worked for the auto industry? Well, you have rural people who moved to the city with only a high school education. But they were able to get outstanding jobs in the auto industry. They bought big homes, made, you know, excellent salaries, but they were trained to do one thing. And when that auto plant closed, first of all, they had a big mortgage. They had lived on a very good salary. They only had a high school education. There are thousands of people out there looking for a job. They want to send their children to college, but they can't afford to. There's a crisis for them. Okay? What could the extended family do for children? The extended family could say, well, there's a crisis there. That child is in Hampton, and the tuition is $10,000 a year. And what we can do is pool our resources together. There's a commitment for this family that the kids will go to college. And so the family, this dominant person, communicates that, and so everybody sends some help. And the idea is that we'll get your child through, and then when mine come, you'll help me get mine through. That's the commitment that the family makes for family well-being, okay? And even when I went to college, even the church becomes a part of the extended family. I recall that when I went to college, that many persons in my little local church would send me in the 60s $5, which was big money in the 60s. I mean, you had enough to make it a couple of weeks, you know? $5. And they'd write me a lovely note saying that they were supporting me, and they would call me their son. I was not really related to them, but I was their son in the church. And they saw young people in that church going to college, and they wanted to support that. Often they had very little themselves, but they wanted to see that child do better, have opportunities that they did not have. That was the fiber that kept the family together. Martin and Martin contend that as this breaks down, we have crisis primarily for children in the African American community because the system is breaking apart. And I tell you, my own family, I'm back to truth again. My grandmother died several years ago. No one else really has assumed that role. Sometimes that does happen. Sometimes the oldest child in the family assumes that role. But no one really has assumed that role. The family gathers sometimes at funerals, at weddings. Thank goodness for the book Roots, because that made us start having family reunions. But often many don't come to the family reunions. This sense of being connected, we've lost some of that. And so some of the strength of my family is gone. My children don't know their cousins. We live in Kentucky. We have no other living relatives that we know of in the state of Kentucky. And so, because I'm a pastor, I don't get weekends off like everybody else does. And so often I miss many of the family events. I only go to one or so a year. And so my children don't know their cousins. I knew all of my cousins. I fought them every summer, okay? I raced them up my grandmother's lane, because sometime during that summer, they were going to come to Virginia and visit grandma. And so I had a week to spend with my cousins. And so I was connected to them. We are losing some of that in the community. Okay? Now, what does that mean for the church? And then we'll open it up for discussion. I think it opens for the church a golden opportunity to step in and provide what this now home extended family is not providing. Because when my relatives return home, although my grandmother's house is torn down and long gone, that church is still there. It still symbolizes something about our family. And very few of them return to Heathsville without going to that church. They will at least go to the cemetery if they won't come in on Sunday morning and hear the message. They'll go to the cemetery and they'll put some flowers on graves, but that connects them with the family. They will explain to their children that they are connected to someone other than the people who just live in their neighborhood in Detroit. They will feel that they belong to a greater, you know, to a family. And they'll find out that they have family members who accomplished good things for their lives under sometimes grave circumstances. They'll find out how brothers and sisters supported each other through college, and they'll see this sense of being connected. What Kwanzaa Kanjufu talks about in his book, Developing Positive Self-Images and Disciplining Black Children, they begin to develop some positive self-images that, you know, I belong to a family that has accomplished something. We are a family, and there are members of our family who went to college with no money, but somehow they got a degree. And they'll say, you know, maybe I can make it to college. Maybe I can accomplish some of those things that other members of my family who really don't have it as well off as I have it can accomplish. And so this sense of belonging and being committed. Well, I think the church can and is beginning to step in and provide what now is, I think, a deficit in the community. And I'm going to leave my script. Okay, because of the time. But what we're seeing is we're seeing models of, oh, the other one I had on there was child rearing. I cut that off. The other thing that extended family did, it provided child rearing within the family. And, you know, like I said, I'm here with no relatives. Major expense, a major problem with us all the time. It's child care. We pay a fortune. And then if my wife and I want to do anything, we've got to pay another fortune after we've already, through that day, paid a fortune. Okay, I just did my taxes, so you know it's on my heart. I looked at how much I spent in child care. I said about two cars or something, you know. But the family provided much of that child care. Okay? And the same values. You know, we had to investigate, do a lot of research on where we're going to put our children. Okay? Now, here's where the church absolutely ought to be involved in child care. Absolutely. First of all, there's a sense of trust. It still needs to be checked out. We know some horror stories. Okay? But there's a sense of a trust in the church. A place where we feel connected to some other people, where our children, who all go to the same church, stay in the same child care center, and we feel a sense of there's a value, whether it's a Christian child care center or just one located in the church. There's a sense of trust that still needs to be, of course, carefully monitored. Okay? I'm convinced that one of the things that every church ought to do for children is to provide what I call it after school care. Let me tell this story. I think it helps illustrate how this is a very kind of a personal kind of story, but I think you can make broader application. I know of a situation of a teenage out of wedlock pregnancy of a young woman who was very active in church, there all the time. In fact, parents in ministry. Okay? The parents were just devastated, just could not believe that their daughter could be pregnant. Such a committed, church-going young lady. And they asked me to talk to her because communication was just closed. And in talking with her and building relationship, what did I find out? She became pregnant at home. And when? After school. Why? Her boyfriend was coming by every afternoon. Her parents are both working, middle-class parents working. All the middle-class values, quote, okay? But her boyfriend was stopping by every day just to say hello, okay? And then she let him in a few times. Parents did not know this, okay? And so what it said to me as I later went back and worked with family, maybe there should have been an alternative for her. Whose daughter can handle her boyfriend coming by every afternoon? Okay? That's a lot of pressure on any teen. Okay? But why not have the church as a place for aftercare? Where they can come and do their homework, have tutoring provided. So churches kind of caught that vision. There's a ministry called Project Spirit in many of the major cities around the country. The Lilly Foundation has supported the movement, where they provide after-school care, a snack, provide some recreation, provide some tutoring and opportunities to do your homework, which is very much needed. Okay, even provide, in some instances, Christian training. Okay, other instances, other kinds of rites of passage training and that kind of thing. Not for profit, but as a ministry to the community. And not just for their members, but for the community as a way of reaching out in love and compassion to the community. It's not really that costly. And so what we're beginning to see is that African-American congregations around the nation are beginning to, as an example, shift their emphasis. They're realizing that the 11 o'clock worship hour is not going to cut it. It's needed. It has its part. Worship is important. But there are other components of ministering to the whole person that the church is going to have to get involved in. The church I'm blessed to serve here, we're about to break ground on the Family Development Center. That is the model all across the country. Not a church country club, as some of them had become, but as an effort to minister to the community, to say even a small church that can afford to build a facility can minister to the children of that community by providing a quality of care. Because the reality is, and I had all these pages of notes, the mother and father, if they're able to find a job, they're both out working. Or if it's a single parent household, that parent needs to have some release time to go get the training necessary to get the job that they need. But they can't afford it because the child care is too expensive. I'm not saying anything new to people in this room. But the church can provide affordable, very affordable child care, after school care, and the list of ministries that the church can provide for children is almost inexhaustible. I mean, the number is staggering when you think about what can happen. And even on a grander scale, several churches, two in particular in Detroit, have pooled their resources together to buy a fast food franchise. Generally, what happens with the African-American community, the statistics say that we are a consumer community, not a producer, producing community. One of the problems, and only 2.7% of all the business in the country are owned by African-Americans. So one of the problems is, how can we get businesses started that will provide those entry-level jobs for our young people? Well, these churches, which, and you know, the biggest business in the black community is black church. See, some people get upset because that's not spiritual. Okay? These are not spiritual things. These are not saving souls and getting folk to heaven. I contend it is. When you have money in your pocket, you're not going to get shot robbing a store. Okay? Maybe you won't be tempted to sell drugs and do all the kinds of things that one does because you want jeans just like everyone else. And you want those $125 Air Jordans that my son will not get, that the other kids want, okay? So you want some of those things, and so if you can't get them by any other means, you take them. But what these churches see, here's an opportunity for us, first of all, to teach young people how to work, to give them responsibility, to hire people in the community, give them some work. So it's fast food, it's no money. It teaches them values, work ethics. They learn to work. They learn that they can make it. They learn ultimately to be managers. And one day, maybe they won't have to stay in that McDonald's, but they'll have the foresight to buy a franchise someplace or go in business with a group and start their own in another location. Training young people, the church can take that role. The church, those churches, for example, I know one in particular only cost them $100,000 to buy a franchise. They opened the franchise. They hired the kids of the church in the community. They hired adults out of the church in the community to run it. And so what do you have? Kids are constantly being trained how to work. They're making money in their own community. And the money is staying in the community because the franchise is there in their community. They're going someplace else to buy McDonald's. So why not do that within their own community? Why not let them work there, learn how to work? And I suggest to you there are hundreds of other kinds of models like that that the church could take a very proactive role rather than these bad children. We don't want them. We ought to say, we want them. We have a golden opportunity to minister to them. I'd like to open it up for questions, discussion. I think we only have 10 minutes left. Yes, reactions.
Can you say a little bit more about the Family Development Center that your church has?
Okay. Right. And we see it, I'm at a small church, so we see that as a step by step. But we see immediately we're committed. Our vision is for a daycare center within 2 years, after school care as soon as we can get that organized, a full-time director with some recreational programs, not only for children, but one of my visions is senior care. Okay? I don't know any African-American church in Louisville that's providing senior care. It's a major problem. I guess I had some in our church where a parent is not ready, they're really not suited for a nursing home, but they live in a household where both people need to go to work, and you can't really trust them to stay home. They leave the stove on and all those kind of things. And so like daycare, I like to call it senior care. And so the black church can provide that. We have that in the black community, and we need that. Not that others wouldn't be, it's an open door. And so we see a multiplicity of ministries that could be started. We already have a tutorial program on Wednesday night, so we're just crammed for space. And so this will go provide us not just one day a week, but it will provide us an opportunity to provide tutoring several times a week. The kids can come by every afternoon and work on their homework and have volunteers from the church to do tutoring. J. Alfred Smith in Oakland, California, Dr. Willis Bennett, some of you Southern Baptists know Dr. Bennett, retired provost of Southern Seminary, took a sabbatical and wrote this book, Effective Urban Church Ministry. It is a case study of Allen Temple Baptist Church in Oakland, California, pastored by J. Alfred Smith. This church has more ministries than I could name in 10 minutes. All kinds of ministries through that church. One of the things it provides is counseling for all age groups through the church. And this is a true story as from his lips. Large congregation. He told me he had four doctoral level professional counselors in his congregation. One of those persons came to him once and said he was interested in being usher president. And he said, you know, I have probably 700 people here who could be usher president. What I need is someone to do some counseling. And that's what you do. And the people of this community, children and adults, can't afford $90 an hour. Okay? And so they found three other people. And he said he had to build a foundation in the Word. And they started a counseling ministry through their church. The church has picked up the liability. We live in that world today. But they provide counseling, not only for people in their church, but for the entire community. Counseling for children as well as adults. That's the kind of ministry that can be a very effective ministry if you have the facility to do it, because you have to have some confidentiality. And many of our churches, we got a sanctuary and a couple of other places. You've got to have some places where you can have confidentiality, where people can come. Otherwise, they won't come. And so that's an opportunity. You know, but churches say, if I don't have that, I'll buy a whole house, and we'll fix it up, and we'll provide that. So we don't have to wait for a building to do that. We can be much more creative in doing that. And there's a sense that, see, as a pastor, many people have a God complex. They want us to have every answer for everything. And some of us, as young people, say, trip out on that. We begin to think that we are God. We have the answer for everybody. And pretty soon we'll burn out and at 45 in our grave. So we need to share that across the board and utilize the gifts. We have social workers and other kind of professionals in our churches. We need to say, although you have a professional life, why not give a part of your service, your profession? Why not offer that to the church, to minister through your church? It's a model that I think the potential, we've just begun to just scratch the surface. Yes.
Walker, one of the problems I see with children is stress. Mm-hmm.
I think things like rites of passage that are being developed where we're kind of helping children go through those developmental stages. I don't know if everybody's familiar with this term, rites of passage. It kind of comes out of the Jewish tradition of bar mitzvah. Is that the way? Bar mitzvah, yes, thank you. Children grow through stages of development. Rites of passage says often what happens if a child is in a single-parent household, for example, often the male is used, that male does not have a male model. Although he grows up, he misses some of those things that you go when you go from boyhood to teenagehood to adulthood. And that we need to be more intentional in helping them to go through those stages, and often by not having someone to teach you to model that for you, it creates real stress. Okay, a good example is I was in a seminar not too long ago, and we had a leadership conference at our church, and I remember the minister who was presenting, he said that sex education for him was an uncle who, I can't show it because it's mixed community here, but it was an uncle who took 3 seconds and told him everything that sex education was. And so as a teenager, he was so stressed because his friends, one friend was telling one thing, another friend was telling another, and there was no adult there to talk with him about this. So very stressful as a teenager, had a lot of myths and a lot of worries. Then the other thing is, the other, which we don't even like to talk about, Kanjufu and others talk about a conspiracy to destroy black boys, were racist institutions, institutional racism, often in our school systems, where kids are not being encouraged to succeed. You know, this is my bias, Walker's editorial, not in a book anyplace, okay? One of the things, I think we gained a lot with the desegregation of schools, please hear me. But the, one of the things that the African American community lost was the mentoring that the black school provided. The excellent student will make it in any environment, but it's that C minus, D plus student who is perceived to be dumb, looked on as dumb, put in special ed, and dies in special ed. Okay? In the black school, you were not allowed to stay there. If there was any hope that you were going to make it, they were going to pull it out of you, or they'd break you. Okay? All right? We don't have that. I mean, lots of teachers in the church I serve, and they said that we have lost that. And so it's creating, again, esteem issues for children, lots of stress for them. They don't feel good about themselves. Black boys, I didn't bring the book with me, an excellent book by, Janice Hale Benson, Black Children.